Now, whether it's the issues of parking, building of a marina, perhaps disturbing remains on the foreshore, Matiatia always seems to be in the local news. And one of the issues that does concern people about Matiatia and proposed development and changes down there is the impact that has on the heritage and history of the location. And so I thought, well, who better to talk to us about that than Paul Monin, who was just about to release a fantastic new book, A History of Matiatia, Gateway to Waiheke. So good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Oh, sorry, we'll turn on your right microphone. There you go, that's better.
Good morning, it's great to be here.
Yeah, now this is a lovely looking book that you've just about to release. It's being launched very, very soon, isn't it?
Yes, official release is December the 7th, which is Friday, and the launch is the following day on Saturday the 8th at Tivoli, 5 p.m.
Now, I mean, Waiheke is a relatively small island. Matiatia, a very particular part of a small island. But you've got enough here to write, you know, a fairly substantial volume on just that place.
Yes. I think I'm correct in saying that very, very few places of this small size have been the subject of a significant book in New Zealand. We are, after all, talking about a valley of only 140 hectares, which is 300 acres, and this is very much a micro study. The justification, though, at the end of the day, is really the geographical attributes of Matiatia Bay. Matiatia Bay is far and away the best natural port on Waiheke Island, and in the last 50 to 60 years, it's become our transport hub. So if you want an overall justification, I think it's that. It's a small place with a big function, and with ever more functions being required of it by some interest groups.
And, yeah, I mean, as I said in the intro, I mean, there is and seems to have been for the last 5 to 10 years kind of ongoing controversy about, you know, potential developments and changes at Matiatia and the nature of whether it's a hub or whether it's a destination and so on. And increasingly people have turned to history and turned to you as a justification to oppose some of that development or proposals for change, haven't they?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, do you find that... Is that people looking for, say, heritage issues to stop development, or has it come from an existing awareness that those heritage issues exist?
Yeah, so I think I think we're going beyond heritage. At Matiatia now, we really are at a major turning point. I think it's the major turning point of the last 100 years. The earlier turning point was the early 20th century when the Allisons took over the farm, when the ownership of the land passed from Māori to Pākehā. 1911 was, coincidentally, 1911 was the year when the first Allison house was barged across the Matiatia. So we're looking at exactly a century. We're at a turning point, and I think whenever you... With any place, when at such a moment, this is the time to look back, because we need to understand how we got to where we are before we can decide intelligently how to move forward. So my book, that's the overall purpose of the book, and of course involved in this explanation of how we've reached where we are, we've got a lot of heritage issues that are of particular interest to me, and a lot of stories, most importantly stories that connect us to Matiatia, and I think those stories that are central to our identity. It would be a disaster if we took steps now that removed vestiges of those stories, knowledge and memory of those stories.
So often now, I think for many people, Matiatia, you know, it's somewhere where they don't pay a lot of, you know, don't give it a lot of thought. It's, you know, oh, which bus do I get on? Oh, damn, there's a ticket on the car, you know, in the car park. But, I mean, you were referring earlier to the fact that it's become, over the last few decades, increasingly a transport hub. But are you able to paint us maybe a little thumbnail sketch of how the bay and how its function and you know, it's gone over the the past?
Yes. I'll do this as quickly as I can. I think most of us are aware that that European economic activity started at the eastern end of the island in the 19th century, based largely on the extraction of kauri timber, of manganese, the wooding and watering of vessels in transit. Into the 20th century, the focal point shifted westwards. Matetia from the 1890s became a very popular destination for yachtsmen. There were periodic visits by steamers, and then with the opening of the historic subdivisions, the 1915 to 1924 subdivisions, each of these subdivisions acquired their own wharf. So we had multiple wharves on Waiheke Island. But these were uneconomic, and by the 1950s it was quite clear that they could not be sustained financially. The Waiheke Shipping Company was failing to make a profit. And in about 1960, Matetia became the sole passenger port on Waiheke Island. So for over 50 years now, Matetia has had that extremely important function of being really the only significant passenger ferry port. There were great hopes that Kennedy Point might come in as a secondary passenger ferry port, but that hasn't come about, and Kennedy Point has been restricted to just freight and vehicles. This is, of course, since it was opened in 1971. But we've had this channeling of services at Matetia. Of course, a precondition of that was the development of a single arterial road system. Only then, if there was a road link between all of our villages, only then could we talk about a single ferry port. And that single arterial system really began in 1938, and by the 1950s it was in place. My overall thesis, transport thesis in the book, is that Matetia now has become what geographers call a choke point. It's a place of congestion in a transport system. The Straits of Gibraltar are probably the best global example of a choke point. The English Channel is a choke point, and as a result, we must face the fact that I think it's going to be very difficult for us to take much of the traffic transport pressure off Matetia. And for that reason, I feel that we should, as we plan for the future, we should give transport issues primacy. Because at the end of the day, what this is all about, two things, I think. One is the superiority of Matetia as a natural harbour. And the other thing are scale economies. You know, that Fullers, I think, would be very reluctant to open a second very serious passenger ferry service at Kennedy Point, because this would increase their costs considerably. And these were the issues that go back to the 1960s, when the Waiheke Shipping Company was approached about opening serious passenger service at Kennedy Point. So at the end of the day, I think we should be very, very cautious about adding additional functions to Matetia like a marina.
Well, I was just to ask you actually about additional functions down there. I mean, but given its suitability as a harbour, and I mean, you know, and in the past, the fact that transport was significantly more difficult or uncomfortable than today, why do you think it is that Matetia didn't become, say, the site of a village?
Good question, Chris. Ironically, Fred Allison had in fact intended Matetia and Church Bay to be included in the large Matetia Onaroa beach estate that he launched in 1924. Maybe I should back up a little bit here. Fred Allison was the owner of the land that was subdivided for the Surfdale Beach Estate and the Ornoroa Matiatia Beach Estate in 1922, 1923, respectively. I've looked into... Fred Allison hoped to, to include Matiatia and Church Bay in that subdivision. In fact, you know, something like 300 or 400 sections were planned. For some reason, the Public Works Department declined this part of the subdivision. The Public Works Department approved the Ornoroa Blackpool parts. Interestingly enough, Nick Johnson in the 1970s, when he was taking paper off a wall at the Harbour Masters, he discovered documents relating to the subdivision of Matiatia and Church Bay. He deposited these papers with the Waikiki Historical Society, and sadly at the moment we don't quite know where they are. But fortunately Simon Johnson of the Gulf News wrote a very good story on this, and he even included photographs of some of the key documents, and I've used those to fill in a gap that I'd like one day to be able to get to the, you know, get an issue to get to the to explore further and understand further. The building of Matiatia Wharf in 1923 was actually based on the assumption that there would be a subdivision of Matiatia. And another wharf was planned for Church Bay. Sorry, Chris, that I'm talking at great length. You could see.
No, I think it's intriguing because, you know, now, you know, I mean, they seem to be in abeyance at the moment, but we've had these proposals to, say, setting up, you know, shopping or cafes and those kind of features at Matiatia. And, you know, and some of the arguments against it, well, you know, we've heard those arguments ad nauseum, I suppose, but about its function. And, you know, it's interesting to hear that there were actually proposals there and, you know, and perhaps they didn't come to fruition. And, I mean, when... I mean, you may have a sense of this. I mean, we have a very kind of involved community, very opinionated about, you know, development anywhere. I mean, has that always been the case? Has there always been, you know, whenever someone has proposed setting up something or building something somewhere on the island, has there always been that outcry? Or is this something which is a more recent function of our community?
No, that's a good question, Chris. I've actually, in my Waiheke Islander history, published back in 1992, I traced that independent, outspoken tradition here right back to the 1840s. For a number of reasons, what Waiheke has attracted quite dynamic, resourceful, self-opinionated, what you will, people in the 1840s. I'm thinking of settlers like Robert McLeod and Isaac Merrick. These were landowners who had to fight for their rights. They disputed with government authorities. They disputed with their neighbours. But I think the community activism here that people like Jacinda Ardern appreciate and Nikki Kaye appreciate, we have a community that's truly democratically active. I trace much of this, though, to the influx of counterculture people in the 1970s. I was one of them, highly educated people. Who felt strongly about environmental issues and human rights issues and so forth, and we've still got that core on the island, 30-40 years standing, and of course I think that we've, you know, to give the newcomers credit, they arrive here and they appreciate the novelty of this place. This place has a distinctive character. It has values that that are of significance, obvious to everyone.
And I suppose when you are looking back over the history of a community like, you know, like Waiheke, that it's that character or that nature of discourse which is the hardest stuff to capture. I mean, you know, yes, you can see plans for subdivision, you can read newspaper articles about, you know, proposals to build shops or, you know, new wharves or whatever, but that feeling of, I suppose, of you know, standing up for the community or speaking out is harder to capture, isn't it?
Yes. And certainly, I think in the 1990s, we started to articulate the Waiheke character. Sandra Lee talked about the Waiheke way. The 2000 document is titled Essentially Waiheke. We do have a real sense of identity here, which I think we've now articulated fairly distinctly. I think, for example, you know, you've referred to the Waiheke Infrastructure Limited proposals for a big development. Those proposals were on the table from 2000 to 2005 until Auckland City purchased Matietia Flat. And the objections basically to the proposals by the people and in the end also by the Environment Court was that the scale of development proposed was too large and urban for Waiheke. It was out of character for this place. We want small-scale development. We want residential rural if we're going to go into our green belt, it has to be development that integrates buildings with you know, the retention of substantial green areas. And and I remember when I you know, in the 1980s, it was often said that, you know, too many Waiheke people were overeducated and underemployed. And that perhaps, rather facetiously, that's an element too, that we've got, well, every census, so it makes it quite clear, we've got the most highly educated population in New Zealand.
And, I mean, what are the things, I mean, at the moment, you know, we've seen, say, with Whareitana Bay, I mean, you know, with Matietia and then more recently with Whareitana Bay, that people are concerned about the heritage of the island being lost. What are the areas, I mean, because if anyone understands that heritage on the island, it's probably you more than anyone, that you feel are most at risk? What are the things that you think we risk losing?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'd like to go back to where I started, really. We are at a turning point, not just at Matietia, I think throughout the island. In other words, we're putting into place now protections that will, I think, determine, that will stand for the next 50 years. We haven't quite finalised the district plan. The district plan has a big heritage component. What's finalised will stand for 50 years. And so it's a critical moment. It's a critical moment for heritage. Let's start there. Getting on to your question, what are the values and which are the values that I'm particularly concerned about? I'm particularly concerned about coastal values. We've got key coastal stretches that are under threat or potentially under threat, and I would include Matietia there. I think Matietia actually building a facility out into the bay will be a new one for us here. We haven't had that yet, and it'll be very difficult to reverse. Any construction down there will be very difficult to reverse, particularly land reclamation for a small car park. We've got encroachment on esplanade strips or coastal yards, as at Whareitana. I fought quite resolutely on the Cactus Bay to Ōwhiti stretch. The development of that coast is only a matter of time, and I'm talking about the coast. Potentially the coast from Cactus Bay right around Hook's Point and back to Manawa Bay. We are going to have to... That's due for some sort of subdivision, big block subdivision in the future, and we will have to ready ourselves for what that will bring in terms of potential modification to that really precious coastal strip.
Now, I suppose looking at the aspects of history that you write about, I mean, you tend to, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you focus, I suppose your starting point is geographical, perhaps. You know, you've talked about the character of people on the island, but you're not a writer who focuses on, say, those kind of social interaction, the people so much. It's more about the history of the place. Would that be a fair summary of your approach?
Yes. I'm my university education also involved geography, so I'm actually very interested in how we use resources. I think my maturity of book is in significant parts. It's almost an historical geographical history or historical geography.
Although of course it does touch on the people, like, you know, Don Chappell, for example.
Oh yes. And also I am very interested in the Pākehā Māori interface. I in fact cut my teeth on treaty history in the 1990s when my early Waiheke book is also, it only takes the story up to 1920, and that really is dominated by race relations and land transactions. So again, that's my experience. I am interested in human interest stories, and in some respects, some of my appeal to audiences is from this quarter. I've had a number of people say, "Oh, Paul, you know, you are good at putting people into your stories," and in some respects, that's all very relative, because most historians, treaty historians, and you know, are a bit weak on that. Yes.
Now, I mean, you mentioned before that you wrote a book, A History of the Island, what, in 1992, and I thought, in fact, just before I came to the island in 96, 97, and when I knew I was shifting here, one of the things I did from Dunedin, I got that book at the library, and I read that book with a map, you know, in one hand and the book in the other, so I kind of knew where I was shifting to. But, and, you know, that's 20 years ago now. But you're still finding new angles, new aspects of those stories to tell. I mean, people sometimes think of the history as static. It's something that's happened. You know, how can you keep on retelling the stories?
Yes, well, history is a work in progress. At no point can we say that this is the definitive history. That's the case for a number of reasons. One, of course, is the fact that new sources are coming to light all the time. I think that... I don't know whether you go online much. I'm not terribly keen, but papers past, historical New Zealand newspapers online is an amazing source. You can just go in there. New Zealand newspapers, a large number of them from the 1840s through to the 1930s are online there. Put in your search word, and I've trawling papers past, I've come across some really interesting human interest stories from Waiheke Island in the 19th century that I would love to have used in earlier writing. I suppose the second, I've talked about new sources coming up, but secondly, I think we also put different questions to the past, depending on current interests. The very famous, I was just thinking about it, the very famous Italian historian Benedetto Croce said that all history is contemporary history. In other words, in that sense, he's meaning that when we look at the past, we're always applying contemporary present-day concerns, questions to it. We're expecting the past to be relevant to our present. And as a result, all history is contestable. I think that history is extremely challenging as an intellectual endeavour and as an area of writing. It's extremely challenging for all of these reasons.
So, I mean, obviously there's a bit of a lag between completing the book and then, you know, getting it to this point where it's, I mean, it's a lovely looking book here I've got in front of me. So no doubt in the meantime, you've started to kind of consider what your next topic might be and where your next bit of writing might be.
Well, I've...
Or have you taken a breather?
Yeah, for 10, 12 years I've been working on a book on the Māori trading fleet of the period 1840 to 1870. This was the time when Māori purchased cutters and schooners to transfer their produce to settler markets. It's a fascinating subject. I've made a bit of a cross for myself because the sources are not that abundant. And also, I'm not a boatie, so I feel that I'm going to have to get a lot of advice from boatie friends to make sure that I don't make any stupid comments about the rigging of these small vessels. So this is my current project. I would also like to write more about Waiheke Island. A lot of people have been pressuring me to republish the 1992 book, but I think what's called for now is a general history right up to the present, focusing on, you know, the main themes, the main issues, with a lot of human interest content, something that something that'll have a broad appeal, something that won't... I have to admit that at times, you know, I do deserve the charge of being a rather academic historian. I do research vigorously, and the skill with research is to try to push it to the background. I think the most severe indictment of a comment on a history writer's work is, oh, your work is well researched. To me, it means it's dense and it's dull. You know, it's heavy going. So I would, if I have time, I would love to write a general Waiheke history. That benefits from the 30 years of work I've done in the field.
And I imagine, you know, there'd be, and I mean, certainly there's an audience for it because, I mean, as you said before, people feel a connection, don't they? I mean, in a different way than someone living in Auckland might read a history of Auckland, someone living on Waiheke is going to feel much more connected to a history of Waiheke.
Yes.
So
yes.
This book, Paul, where is it available?
Yes, that's going to be on sale in the two honor roll bookshops, Take Note and Tivoli. I'm launching at Tivoli, as I said before, I'm launching on Saturday, the 8th of December at 5 p.m. in the forecourt in front of Tivoli. There will be some wine and nibbles. Everyone's welcomed. I'll be there to sign and chat with people. So I'd love to see a great turnout.
Yeah, great.
Mike Lee is the guest speaker, and Bruce Kroll is the special guest. Bruce Kroll has been a wonderful source of oral information for me, and as I mentioned, I think I did, that 1911 Allison House was the Kroll house that was barged across. His Don's grandfather and father were present on that occasion. So we've got in Bruce Kroll, we've got a fantastic personal connection with the bay.
Fantastic. And just putting you on the spot, we'd love to have you back at some point just to kind of maybe pick out particular parts of the island and tell some of the stories in more detail. It's been fascinating having you here this morning.
No, that'll be a pleasure, Chris.
Great. Yes. Well, thanks very much. This is Paul Monin, author of Matiatia, Gateway to Waiheke, which, as he says, is being launched on December the 8th and highly recommended by us here at Waiheke Radio. Thanks very much, Paul.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.